listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. As Diane Ackerman writes in her brilliant new book, The Human Age, quote, our relationship with nature has changed radically, irreversibly, but by no means all for the bad. Our new epoch is laced with invention. Our mistakes are legion, but our talent is immeasurable. We've altered the pH of the oceans and decisively changed the carbon cycle, and you have only to step outside the air-conditioned comfort of Central Library to experience that reality. We are now in the Anthropocene, the human age, where for the first time, Homo sapiens' impacts are being written into the fossil record. Diane Ackerman, a prolific poet and essayist, is justly celebrated for her unique insights into the natural world and our place in it. And in this landmark book, she confronts the unprecedented reality that one prodigiously intelligent and meddlesome creature, Homo sapiens, us, all of us, is now the dominant force shaping the future of planet Earth. She offers both sobering reality and as well illuminates optimistic innovations that allow us to wager on the sheer possibility of delight, if only just barely trouncing despair. Diane Ackerman is one of our finest literary interpreters of science and nature. She's the author of over 24 highly acclaimed works of nonfiction and poetry, including the best-selling The Zookeeper's Wife and A Natural History of the Senses. She's the recipient of many awards and has been named a literary lion by the New York Public Library. So she's been named a literary lion, but she's even had a molecule that's been named after her, Diane Ackerman. So that's pretty special. And in conversation with Diane Ackerman tonight, we're thrilled to welcome back to the Aloud stage Dr. Amy Parrish, a biological anthropologist, primatologist, and Darwinian feminist. Dr. Parrish has taught at many universities, including USC, Georgetown University, and she's currently affiliated with University College London. For the past 2 decades, Dr. Parrish has been studying the world's captive population of bonobos, who are, along with chimpanzees, the two closest relatives, living relatives, of humans living today. And in all of her research, Dr. Parrish uses an evolutionary approach to shed light on the origins of human behavior. So she has yet to have a molecule named for her, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's in her future. So please join me in welcoming Diane Ackerman and Dr. Amy Parrish.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It's really nice that you all came out and braved the weather, which is not in the contract we all signed for living in LA. But it's a real pleasure to be here tonight talking with Diane Ackerman. I loved The Human Age, and I was already sold because I loved Zookeeper's Wife so much. And maybe some of you were here when Diane was here at the library previously in dialogue with Louise on that book. This is a very pertinent book to a lot of the discussions that we're having at the moment about climate change, but also more broadly about what it means to be a human and whether what it means to be a human is different now than how we perceived it even half of a century ago. So I thought we might start because one of the frequently used terms in the book is the Anthropocene. If you'd be willing to tell us a little bit about what it means to be living in the Anthropocene and...
Yes, I think we really do live in a new era. Human beings have been on the planet for about 200,000 years, but it's really only in the last 200 years that all of the wonders, most of the wonders that we associate with everyday life were invented. And in the last 20 years, the human adventure has just been accelerating at a mind-boggling pace. And so in order to highlight how we have now achieved this dominion over the entire planet, an international coalition of scientists is arguing that we need to change the geologic era, the name of the era in which we live, from Holocene, which is part of that, to something that better represents the impact we're having. And so they have suggested Anthropocene, or however we're going to say it, which translates as the human age. What they're debating at the moment is pretty much where it should begin. Did it really start with agriculture? Certainly we began to change our own evolution with agriculture. Or did it begin with the Industrial Revolution? That's what I'm voting for. Did it begin with the atom bomb? But I think almost certainly it's going to be adopted by 2016. And at that point, all the textbooks will have to be rewritten. And children are going to be taught a very exciting, I hope, maybe partially disturbing, new reality. That we have become the most powerful species on the entire planet. And it's been happening without our really paying attention and noticing. And a lot of it has been happening accidentally. You know, it's not that we're an evil species, contrary to what we see in the news all the time. What we see in the news is grim, mainly because of the way the media works, I think. The motto that I've heard often is, if it bleeds, it leads. And if you were to just pay attention to that, you would think all humans are evil. And by the way, we have irrevocably damaged the planet. And I'm much more hopeful than that about our future as a species, and also about our disposition as human beings and the good side of our nature. So I became, when I started learning about the Anthropocene, it overlapped with my noticing that nature seemed to be changing, our relationship with nature, every single facet of it. Nature all around us, what we mean by nature, is nature even natural anymore? And the nature inside of us. We used to think that DNA told the whole story. Now we know it's more complicated than that. All of this was changing, and I decided it was time that I really took a hard look at what everyday life is like for us anthrops.
Yeah, and I think another thing that's likely to change, maybe not by 2016, but sometime soon, is our scientific classification of humans. So until now, we've been in our own genus, Homo sapiens. But if Linnaeus had used the same classification criteria that he used for all the other animals on the planet, he would have put us in the same genus with chimpanzees and bonobos. So either we would be pan-sapiens or they would be Homo troglodytes and Homo paniscus. So at the same time that there's such a great case to be made for us being really unique and having driving the biggest changes on the planet, we're also more and more recognizing our commonalities with other apes. And you open your book talking about a particular ape that you got to observe up close, and I just found it so fascinating what we learned about their capacities.
Well, thank you. He actually is sitting on the front of the book, and he has an iPad that he's playing with. You're laughing, but there is a wonderful orangutan outreach program called Apps for Apes. It's just what you think it is. They give iPads to the great apes because we have come to understand so much better about the minds of other animals, and that there are many animals on the planet that have self-awareness, that really have the IQ of like a human 3 or 4 year old. We were talking just before we came out about some things that orangutans we knew or had read of had done. One I had spoken of had learned how to use a paperclip that he found and pick the lock on the cage. But that's not what is so intriguing. What's intriguing is that he knew that if he folded it back up and hid it under his lip, the keeper wouldn't know he had it.
Yeah, and Franz de Waal has a great story about chimpanzees where they would bury fruit in the enclosure every day, and the chimps knew it was there somewhere, would come out and look for it, and one day none of the chimps found it, and so the day wore on and they gave up, and everybody went to sleep in the afternoon, and then a very low-ranking juvenile male sat bolt upright, it was clear he hadn't been asleep at all, looked around, went silently to exactly where the food was, and dug it up and ate it. That shows a lot of foresight to be able to plan ahead and deceive all the others and inhibit your excitement about the food, and, you know, in order to plan ahead like that.
I mean, technically, are we not called Homo sapiens sapiens?
We are, and we share a close relationship with some other Homo sapiens, the Neanderthals, who many people don't realize are actually not only the same genus, but the same species as us. And you write about our relationship with Neanderthals in the book.
We got a lot of our smarts from them, probably, and tool usage. Blue eyes, right?
Exactly. So that you can see in low light in caves. Neanderthals spend a lot of their time in caves, and if you have light eyes...
We've underestimated them. I think one of the big issues, I write about the frozen arc in here, and that's a doomsday project in England where they are storing the DNA from all of the endangered animals against that rainiest of days when we may feel that we need to either de-extinct, the term is, a species, or more likely use the genes to enrich a terribly inbred gene pool. But, you know, one of the questions now that's on the table is, do we de-extinct the woolly mammoth? A lot of people would like to do that.
Right.
The idea is that an elephant would be carrying the embryo. I presume she would be really surprised when the baby mammoth came out, you know. And also that it would be a very strange culture for this woolly mammoth baby because... we all learn, all the other animals do too, from their parents. And so it wouldn't be exactly a woolly mammoth culture, and there wouldn't be all of those friendly and not so friendly bacteria that they had affecting their personalities and stuff. So that would be awkward. The more awkward question is, do we de-extinct Neanderthals?
Have you had your DNA tested?
No. Do you know what percentage you are?
I don't, but I hope it's a lot.
I insist that I dated a lot of guys in high school who were clearly high Neanderthal.
But that's the old view of Neanderthals before.
Yes, exactly. That's the old view right now.
Right. You know. Well, I was fascinated in your book because of a link that I saw with Zookeeper's Wife. And Zookeeper's Wife, you talked about the Nazi idea of bringing back extinct species because they venerated, it was really interesting to me that they venerated kind of pure bred bloodlines of particular animals like European cattle and things like that. And of course that seemed so wrong. And yet here we are now preserving all these animals or maybe trying to bring back extinct animals.
Just so. And there is this movement of rewilding, which you may have heard of, where they're doing exactly that. And with some of the same animals too. Which raises the question, if you reintroduce the woolly mammoth into northern Russia, maybe it would survive just fine, but surely it would outcompete some other animals, and then it would be an invasive species not from someplace else. It would be from elsewhen.
Right.
That would be very odd. It seems very Anthropocene of us that we are getting into these situations.
Well, and you also mentioned plants in this book, so that was kind of carried over from the animal discussion in the other book, and how you know, we've domesticated, I think 90% of what we're growing now is stuff that humans domesticated. And it made me think of Michael Pollan and his work, at least on
intriguing some. Last name, don't you think?
It is. It's so appropriate.
Yeah.
And, you know, he makes the argument that many plants have domesticated us.
Oh, I agree. And we've domesticated ourselves a lot, too. Before agriculture, when we were hunter-gatherers, we had sharp teeth, and we had a lot of protein. We grew taller. Then all of a sudden, our teeth got blunter. We didn't need to be ripping and tearing, despite what we see in all the vampire movies that are so popular now. And we weren't growing as tall until we invented a different kind of plow that made it possible to grow a third crop each season, and that crop turned out to be beans. So suddenly, we had protein in the diet again, and not surprisingly, people started growing taller again. There are even some people who argue that that's how the Renaissance came in. We suddenly had all this brain food going on that we didn't have.
And then we seem to be having an effect on other urban species of animal where we're making them smarter?
Well, we're making rats smarter, which is not necessarily something you might like. We're making spiders larger than their country equivalents. I was just learning about this past week because unfortunately, when I finish a book, I don't just like turn off and stop losing my obsession about it. I'm still obsessed and learning. And the city spiders are much bigger, apparently because of the artificial light. It's like take out food. They suddenly have their food brought to them. They don't have to work so hard. You know, they're not burning as many calories from it. But we are affecting the wingspan of swallows, cliff swallows. They don't mind that there aren't cliffs in the cities. They can just roost on buildings. But the traffic is a problem. So the ones who survive are the ones with shorter wingspans who can dart in around the cars like jets, and then they pass on their genes. But isn't that unusual to be able to see evolution happening right before our eyes like this?
Yeah, mostly. Some evolution can be quite quick. So the HIV virus, for instance.
Yes, that's right.
Replication. I think that's what we often leave out of our analysis when we're thinking about how amazing humans are and how much we're changing things, is what is the power of a virus or bacteria to change things quite quickly? And of course, we've got Ebola right now on our minds, at least.
Yes.
I hope we do.
But it is intriguing to be able to see things. I mean, I was raised that Darwinian evolution was glacial, and that you would never see anything like that happening in your own lifetime. But of course, we are seeing it.
We are. There's some fantastic work by Peter and Rosemary Grant in the Galapagos Islands, where they looked at finch beak depth. And after 2 years of drought, only 10% of the population survived. And it was the ones with deep beaks that could open the hardest seeds and largest seeds. And it was a complete shift in that, and they were so excited because, you know, the Galapagos is sort of where Darwin got all of his inspiration, and they were able also to see evolution in action. So
that's so cool.
It really is. It's so exciting.
I think I would like to go and see that.
And see that, yeah. It's really a wonderful thing. Well, as I was thinking about your book, I was thinking about just the fascinating amount of information about the past, the present, and the future. And past, I guess you might define as pre-1800 then?
I think so. I think it, look, we could start much more recently than that. Consider plastic. Now, plastic is going to be one of the things that we leave in the fossil record, really identifiable with our era. And it's going to be little plastic tears because plastic doesn't degrade to anything smaller than that, really. But plastics came in the 1940s and the 1950s and now completely dominate our lives. They came in with frozen foods and cake mixes and the bomb and so on.
Estrogenizing all of us and, you know, having this huge effect on males of all kinds of species, including humans. So,
wait, what is?
The plastics.
Ah, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, and well, I feel like your book is a really good balance between the good and the bad on every issue that you raise. And
I think I'm very much a realist about, let's say, climate. I'm a realist about these things. I believe that climate change is real, is urgent, and we've caused it, but not on purpose, and that we need to really tend to it immediately. But I'm also an optimist. I also believe that there is a lot that we can do, that we've already proven that we can change the world. We've done that, not for the better. Imagine what would happen if we became aware as we are now and put our minds to it and decided we were going to change it again, this time to improve things. I know there's a lot of climate change that is probably irreversible. You know, probably the Greenland ice shelf is going to continue melting for quite a while. But there's an awful lot that we can slow down and that we can offset if we really start concentrating on it. And I started looking at sustainability practices that countries were doing, that individuals were doing all over the world. And it's very inspiring and it's very encouraging. There is an enormous amount of creativity and inventiveness mm-hmm. out there. And there's a climate march that's going to be starting in about a week in New York that's going to have hundreds of thousands. I think of a lot of young people probably.
Yeah.
This is becoming the great or one of the great moral issues of our age. And I'm a kid of the 60s. Are there other boomers out there? Oh, yeah. Well, so like me, you lived through a time of great moral tumult. You know, we discovered the power of individuals and the muscle of activism. And in my lifetime alone, I've witnessed integration, the women's rights movement, the Vietnam War, apartheid, gay rights, so many moral issues of exactly the kind that can be used to change laws. And Al Gore is someone who has pointed out this is that kind of moral collision, and it can change laws. And I see a lot of that going on right now. The EPA is out there saying, okay, we have no choice. We must cap emissions, and this is the way it's going to be. And we have to put a tax on carbon, not to penalize the oil companies and the oil users, but to persuade them in a way that is most familiar to them, that it would be in their best interest to choose something like renewables, which are going to end up being a lot cheaper. And renewables are becoming much cheaper, much faster than any of us realized. So I'm actually very optimistic for just countless reasons when I start looking around and seeing what people are doing and countries are doing, and just think about what human beings are capable of.
Well, and that's a great point about the carrot and the stick. So certainly we know that taxing things works really well if you want to change tobacco smoking behavior. If you tax
yes.
those, it's one of the most effective ways. And as you point out in your book, we're almost like a eusocial species. We can't survive without each other. So we're very in tune to the attitudes of the group. So I know that in hotels, they weren't getting a lot of success with the little signs they put in your room asking you to reuse your towels. So they changed it and they said 72% of guests who stayed here in the past chose to reuse their towels. Will you join them? And that was much more effective. It made a really big difference in how many people. And I think that could be applied in so many different.
I think so too. We saw how the digital revolution brought in globalization and the idea that you could influence somebody half a planet away. I think we're seeing that climate change is bringing a different kind of globalization, that we're now starting to realize that we not only have everything in common with every other person on the planet, but that we all are intimately connected to every facet of nature also. And even Pope Francis is talking about this, that if we are not kind to nature, nature is not going to be kind to us.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of people are making the point that, you know, the Earth might go on and survive just fine without
us. Oh, sure.
But, you know, that it's fairly likely if we don't change radically that we'll be gone. And that wouldn't be really that unusual either. Species come and they go. I was a little shocked in your book. I think, was it by the year 2100, 60% of the species now on the planet are not going to be here?
That's pretty scary. Unless we come up with some really great ways to protect them. Mm-hmm. But you were mentioning our being a eusocial mm-hmm. species, like one of my personal favorites, the blind mole rat.
Naked mole rats.
Naked
mole rats.
Forgive
but they
me.
They are blind.
Yes, they're not blind. The naked
like
mole rats.
Penises.
Yes, excuse me.
just so you can conjure them up.
And yeah, that's really important. They're ever so cute. We're learning now, as we're learning about the microbiome, that each of us is a superorganism. Mm-hmm. And that only, I think it's 10 times as many bacterial DNA fragments we have than human. We are actually more bacteria running around. Also, we share it with others all the time and the rest of nature. This is only disturbing if you really didn't want to continue carrying the memory of like a bad relationship you had, let alone the DNA around with you for a long time. But good if you are thinking that you have some of the bacterial stuff and everything from people that you loved, that you have literally absorbed them to some extent. It means that we're constantly flowing. We don't see ourselves that way. We see ourselves as separate. And somebody is walking towards us and we recognize them as one person. Mm-hmm. But actually, they are eusocial. And so we are a superorganism among larger superorganism on a planet that is a superorganism, and I think we could just continue going.
Yeah. And it's so interesting how you approach the book from space, mm-hmm. and from land and from sea, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit maybe first about space and how we can understand.
I was in the Journalist in Space project many years ago. Do you remember that? And I made it into the finals, but then there was the Challenger disaster, and that was put aside. One of the things that was most interesting about it is that everybody had to be photogenic and videogenic, and they made you be photographed in a certain way. All of the women had to be photographed like this. High school yearbook, right? Like that. I set my hair. I really wanted to go, you know.
And what was the posture for the men, do you remember?
Oh, it was probably something, if it wasn't like, what do you call that, shooting the cuff? You know, where if you're standing like that or something.
Oh, no.
It was probably like this or something, manly.
Well, I remember the image we sent up into space that was supposed to represent humans in case anybody encountered it was a man looking straight out at the world, very strong, and then a diminutive woman looking sideways at him,
yes,
adoringly,
yes,
with her hand on his arm.
And, yeah. But the thing that is most extraordinary, and part of the reason that I have a chapter in which, okay, this is a spoiler alert, mm-hmm. There are space-faring beings, and they are coming, they're searching for intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. And you think it's us doing that, but then you discover that actually it's extraterrestrials, and they've come into our own solar system. And all of a sudden, they see this one planet that is completely lit up at night. It's dazzling, it's sparkling with all of these lights. And the lights are too regular. They have too much method to them to be natural. It's clear that this is a planet that is inhabited by intelligent beings who, for some reason, are obsessed with signing their name in this luminous ink all over the planet. Yeah.
And that has a big effect on our biology as well. All of this artificial light,
you know, yes,
speeds up the age at which girls achieve their first menstruation, and it's
yes.
another example.
Plus, we can go around at night,
and we sleep far less than other primates. Most primates sleep either from dusk to dawn or dawn to dusk. But I wonder, you know, how that's affected us to have so many fewer hours.
I wonder, especially with what we're learning about the importance of sleep now.
Yeah,
and I know that night workers run into certain kinds of problems too.
So in some ways, we can't escape our biology. We're still wedded to it.
It's odd. We've become an urban species very recently.
I liked how you called them urban primates.
We are urban primates. Yes, as a primatologist, you like that. It could be a new specialty.
Yeah, that's true.
Speaking of new specialties, that was one of the reasons that I wanted to write this also. One of the people I visited in here is a wonderful gentleman named Lawrence Bonasar, whose specialty didn't even exist when he was in college. What he does is 3D print organs for transplantation. He uses a 3D printer, which works like an inkjet printer. It just goes back and forth, and it adds up minute amounts until it builds up whatever it is. But the ink that he uses is living cells and collagen. And he chose cartilage and ears because there are children who were born with deformed ears, and he has small kids and is very sympathetic to this plight and decided to do that. But he was also working on cartilage, not just for human spines, but for our pets. You were talking about eugenics earlier and breeding and how the Nazis bred things, but just look around at our dogs. They don't look very much like wolves. We've completely decided what they are going to look like and what their behavior will be like.
And who their mates will be.
Yeah, everything.
None of that's up to them anymore.
Nope.
But in exchange, they get a free ride. I mean, I think they're genius.
Yeah.
There are very few other species I can think who've so well co-opted another species to just serve all their needs. It's fascinating.
Yeah, that's true. They've done a pretty good job of it, haven't
they? There's some mechanism in our brain that's really vulnerable to that.
But it's a funny idea because there was a time when we did live under roof with other animals, but they were like cows and sheep and goats and stuff.
Yeah.
And we pretend that we're a peripheral to nature, that we don't need nature, but then we obsessively bring it right indoors all the time. We scent everything that touches our lives. We have windows. You can go stroke a wall and it will be winter or summer or night or day. And we have pets with us too.
There's definitely a longing for nature. To just return for a moment to this this idea of which species are venerated and what makes a good genome and the whole kind of Nazi idea of eugenics on other animals, I wonder if you followed the controversy in Denmark over euthanizing the giraffes.
No.
The Copenhagen Zoo, they decided that, I think it was two giraffes in the end, didn't have the right combination of genes. They were hybrids. And so they decided to euthanize them.
Oh, dear.
And then, butcher them in public and feed them to the lions because they were pragmatic and thought this would be a good lesson in nature. And I thought of it when I was reading your book because I think it's so strange how we think we can decide, you know, what are good genes and what are bad genes. And, I mean, the red wolf, we spent millions of dollars saving the red wolf, and then suddenly some scientists said it's not a true species, it's a hybrid between a gray wolf and a coyote, and then people just completely lost interest as if the value of it had changed overnight. And it's so interesting.
Those humans, really.
It's one of the oddities about us.
Yeah, we are such a weird species.
Well, and so I wanted to ask you, what comes next? You talk about robots and
a completely synthetic species, right?
Right.
I spent a little bit of time with a pioneer in robotics who is trying to invent robot sapiens. A robot species that will have emotions, very deep emotions, he says. They just won't be human. I said, tell me a little bit more about these deep emotions that won't be human. He said, well, of course, it's possible that these robots could learn things that you didn't particularly want them to learn, but that they can't forget. I thought, great, now we have traumatized robots. That's just what we need. Now what do you do? And I thought maybe there would have to be special therapists, you know, that they went to, and special orders, religious orders, who, you know, would take care of them. Our sisters of perpetual motion, and, you know, stuff like that.
Well, it's interesting. In the movie Her, I found that so provocative to think about robots evolving and how they learn.
They can do that now.
How they feel inadequate. And
In
what ways can they do that now?
Well, already he has designed robots that can evolve new versions of themselves. And there are other people around the world that have invented robots that can do their own evolution faster, you know, at robot speed. And they have incidentally come up with primitive consciousness in the process where they can observe some other creature or robot, and they have the theory of mind to figure out probably what that other life form is going to do. Well, that's remarkable, you know, that, I mean, we evolved our empathy for very practical purposes, and they can do that too. It's going to take a long time before we have that parallel species, but they can do art. I don't know if they can, if they have robotic stand-up comedians.
Mm. You know, what's their sense of humor like?
That's yes. Really, what would their sense of humor be like? Would they have the equivalent of a horse goes into a bar and the barkeeper says, "Why the long face?" You know, I don't know what they would have.
I've already been amazed by what Siri can do. So I thought I was texting my partner, and I said, "Thank you for the help. Love you, honey." And she replied, and I guess I was talking to Siri, and she replied, "What a nice thing to say." It's really eerie feeling.
Yes. Well, he was telling me, this is Hod Lipson at Cornell, was telling me that he had his robots doing some art. And they were doing a kind of Motherwell sort of thing, style. And they were submitted to the Yale Museum, who accepted them, and then unaccepted them when they realized that it was robots that who had done them.
Or a robot would say, "I'm in love with your refrigerator.
Love
with your what?
Refrigerator.
Yes.
That's true. Oh, my goodness. Well, you have some fascinating examples of, in our own lives, how robots are touching us with plants that I just found so.
Yes, plants can now, well, they don't sext to you. I guess they kind of do. They text to you, though. They can. They can tell you if they're mad at you, and crops can, too. They can tell the farmer if they haven't been watered enough or fed enough. And I think that there is a whole new industry for creative writing majors out there. Probably Garrison Keillor would be super interested in this, designing what they would get to say. So I have them, one thing they could say is, "With fronds like you, who needs anemones?" But somebody's got to make up the things, right, for them to say. And I was just talking with someone this afternoon who told me that her husband had taken up grilling, and he is a computer person, and so he invested in a device that allows the pork chop or whatever it is to send you a message, yes, saying if it's being overcooked or undercooked, and then you run out and you change the temperature.
And all of that seems like progress, but you also have some examples in the book where we make big mistakes in the name of progress. I think with the snails, maybe you could, do you remember that?
Oh, well, yeah, we do. We do this. Our intentions are good, for the most part. We think, why don't, you know, we're overrun with beetles. Why don't we bring in a kind of toad that would eat them? And then the next thing you know, it's just wall-to-wall cane toads every place you can possibly look. Or brown tree snakes. Or the wolf snail that eats up all of the other snails. It's because we haven't really used enough oversight. And that is something that I do seriously think we're going to have to see a lot of in the future, which is college departments of biomedical ethics, computer ethics, nanotechnology ethics, and such, because we are much better able to change the world right now than we are to understand it. And that's not a very safe situation for us to be in. So do we need to have tomatoes that contain the genes of wild salmon? Probably not, but you can buy them. Mm-hmm. And it's not to make the tomatoes redder, as you might think. It's to help withstand cold. It's one thing if we are talking about healing children who are born or going to be born with some genetic anomaly. Of course you would want to spare them. But do we really need to be having pets that fluoresce green because they contain squid elements and stuff? Again, you can buy them now if you want. You could have a fluorescent, green fluorescent cat. Or, yes, I know, it would be ever so interesting on Halloween and stuff. But or fish.
Right.
You can go into pet stores and get them now. So already we are able to do things that should give us pause, and we should stop and at least be thinking about, especially if we're mixing different species.
And how about the weaponized bats? That seemed ill-advised.
The weaponized bats, yes. Well, we've drafted a lot of animals to fight our wars for us. I write about how our relationship with animals has been changing, of course, and in many wonderful ways. We're becoming much more sympathetic to the plight of other species, to how much we have in common with other species, to the minds and emotions of other species. I think it's absolutely wonderful that that's true. And it's helping us realize that if we have to fight wars, let drones do it, even though it would be really nice if we didn't have any need for them at all. But to have millions upon millions of animals that we're sending out, whether they're dolphins or sea lions or horses or dogs, they strike us as the innocent among us that we're sending out to die like that. But if you learn about the animals that the government really was planning to use, it's pretty scary. Glowworms, okay. I get glowworms. They were being taken into the trenches in World War I to use as lamps. And the idea was that the enemy would just see glowworms, right? You know, it wouldn't be like seeing flashlights or candles or anything. But there was a bat bomb project, and the idea, there was also a bat kitty project, which really, the logic that went into this is pretty scary. It makes you wonder, yes, about, you know, government intelligence agency, that kind of thing. The idea was that you drop a cat. Cats don't want to land in water. They will steer the bomb to the ship. The idea with the bats was that the bats were incendiary bombs, and they were supposed to be dropped over Japan, lots of paper houses. They would go roost in the paper houses, and the bombs would go off and set the city on fire, except that unfortunately it set the facility where they were being, this was being designed on fire, and they thought maybe this, you know, wasn't such a great concept.
I think it's took out an airbase, right?
Yeah.
Just amazing.
They've used, there was Operation Acoustic Kitty, in which they had listening devices and cat's tails, and then they would just kind of deposit the cat near where they thought some Russian agents were going to be meeting and talking and stuff like that. Just all manner of crazy things. There's a beautiful war memorial to the animals that we drafted in war that you can find in Hyde Park in London. And I really encourage you to go and visit it if you're ever there. It's absolutely exquisite. And it celebrates them, and then it tells you in kind of small print underneath, they had no choice. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And here in this country, we used chimps in the space program. And
oh yes,
they were trained in the return shuttle to make certain maneuvers, and they would be rewarded with peanuts that came out of a little chute. And if they did the wrong thing, they would be shocked. But the capsule started malfunctioning, so that they got shocked even for doing the right thing, and they still did the right things and landed the capsule for us. Which I think is a real testament to why it's so easy to make apps for apes. And,
yeah.
You know, it's really...
Yeah. Did I mention that this wonderful orangutan that I met could Skype? you can probably Skype. I'm just, you know, I've Skyped maybe once. But this orang can Skype. But tellingly, when he did, it was the head of the orangutan outreach who was talking to him. From the iPad and calling him by name. And his keeper, that he was very fond of, was standing right next to him. So there's this human here. There's this human here. This guy's talking to him. And what did the orang do? He touched the human. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the kind of thing we would do. What's going on here? Is there a human in here? What's happening exactly? This guy's three-dimensional. This one is...
It's really hard to figure that out. I mean, I think if we were starting from scratch, we would probably spin all kinds of stories about extraterrestrials or religious experiences.
Probably.
And who knows?
Who knows they're what they're spinning?
Right,
yes,
right.
That's
but
true.
We might be able to find out at some point.
They play piano on that. Peter Gabriel has jammed with some bonobos.
Yeah,
done duets and stuff. And he is one of a number of people very seriously working on an interspecies internet in which members of different other intelligent species could talk to one another and maybe talk with us too in some way. They're already using touch screens with dolphins, I know, underwater. Part of what's so moving to me is that we feel such compassion for other animals now that we realize are intelligent. And we are so saturated with our digital life that we just naturally want to share it. We feel we have to share it with them. But they're not as taken by it as we are. The keeper, Matt Berridge, happened to have kids at home, sons who were the same age as this chimp, but he pointed out that his kids are way more obsessed with their iPad than this chimp was. So maybe, you know, the chimp knew something.
Yeah, I think we can learn a lot from the world around us, and you've really illustrated that so well in this book. And I love that you gave us a reason for hope at the end, and I was wondering if you might be willing to share that passage with us.
I feel enormous hope for us as a species. We've created a lot of planetary chaos. There's no question about it. We need to take care of it. But we are not doomed, and we are not powerless, and we are not helpless. We have the resources and the intelligence and the imagination, we're improving this every single day, to be able to really pitch in now and stop it in its tracks and ensure that we have a livable world. In the industrial age, we found it thrilling to try to master nature everywhere and in every way we could think of. In the Anthropocene, we're engineering ways to help the most vulnerable people adapt and designing long-term solutions to blunt global warming. Humans are relentless problem solvers who relish big adventures, and climate change is attracting a wealth of clever minds and unorthodox ideas, as we're revisiting the art of adapting to the environment, a skill that served our ancestors well for millennia while they fanned out to populate the Earth from equator to ice. We can survive our rude infancy and grow into responsible, caring adults without losing our innocence, playfulness, or sense of wonder. But first, we need to see ourselves from different angles and many mirrors as a very young species, both blessed and cursed by our prowess. Instead of ignoring or plundering nature, we need to refine our natural place in it. Nature is still our mother, but she's grown older and less independent. We've grown more self-reliant, and as a result, we're beginning to redefine our relationship to her. We still need and cling to her, still find refuge in her flowing skirts and food at her table. We may not worship Mother Nature, but we love and respect her, are fascinated by her secrets, worry about alienating her, fear her harshest moods, cannot survive without her. As we're becoming acutely aware of just how vulnerable she truly is, we're beginning to see her limits as well as her bounty, and we're trying to grow into the role of loving caregivers. We're at a great turning, our own momentous fork in the road. Behind us, eons of geological history, ahead a mist-laden future, and all around us, the wonders and uncertainties of the human age. These days, startling though the thought is, we control our own legacy now. We're not passive, we're not helpless, we're earth movers. We can become earth restorers and earth guardians. We still have time and talent, and we have a great many choices. As I said at the beginning of this mental caravan, our mistakes are legion, but our imagination is immeasurable.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We would love to open up the discussion now to the audience. Please raise your hand and someone will bring a mic to you because we do record for podcast.
And because we are so technologically competent that we have these things.
Hi. I had seen recently, it's a dated documentary, but about an orangutan that was raised at birth in, I think, a Midwestern, maybe University of Illinois or something. And had all this great language and interaction. Finally, the university said, oh, she's just taken over everywhere. So ethically, the issues of ethics that you would bring up, but also the iPad, is there, should we say, oh, their natural state would never have an iPad, or, gee, they've got all this potential, and why not let them grow just like we're growing?
I'm really, it's a question that could be debated for a long time. I think that... we've proven that we haven't found that one fix is going to work for preserving all animals and all of the environment. And we haven't exactly figured out whether we should be hands-off or hands-on. There are people in both camps. We've touched every inch of the planet, but we still like to have some areas that we designate wild and some animals that we designate wild, even though, of course, we've tampered with their ecosystems in many ways. The animals that are in zoos are a special case. They didn't choose to be ambassadors for their species. And yet, it's important, in the case of like an orangutan, that people be able to look at this animal and learn that, boy, his relatives are going to disappear really fast if we don't start doing something right away. And by the way, Nestle Foods recently came out, very recently, and announced that it was going to stop buying its palm oil from the Indonesian forests for precisely this reason, because it was killing the habitat of a lot of endangered animals, like the orangs. I understand that when they are living among us, they're influenced so completely by our culture anyway. They don't have their own culture, really. That it would be such a hardship to think of them being bored and not having something, as much stimulation mentally and enrichment as possible. In the wild, I wouldn't want it. How about you?
Yeah, well, I echo what you're saying about the captive situation when we are their guardians, is the current 21st century term.
Is that the term now?
Yes, we are their guardians. I do think it's important to provide as much stimulation as possible, and they're so closely genetically related to us. A bonobo and a chimp are 98.5% identical to us, that why would we withhold that from them? This year I've been working on a project at the Stuttgart Zoo, where I made films for the bonobos there, and I spent the year collecting data on them, and they like watching TV just as much as mm-hmm. we do. And they immediately have their favorite spots, they get a snack, the male's kind of, make an armchair. It's really interesting. So I think it's nice to see them enjoying something, and then it's a whole new venue through which we can interact with them. Mm-hmm. So I think what would be really interesting is, to try to provide to them more information about us, because I think they know very little about us, and here's an opportunity to show them our parenting style, our patterns of aggression, maybe our sexual behavior, if the zoo would allow that, I don't know. But, I think those things are, it's time in the 21st century to really think of them as co-beings with us, and where we're not
smart.
Them. And
smart. I mean, how would you react, to a 3 or 4 year old human? Yeah. You would want these things for that child too. I know that Matt was very keen that they be able to make as many choices as they possibly could, mm-hmm. because they were so restricted in the amount of volition that they had. So he was. Booty was able to decide whether he would open the door into the next section and what he would do or what he wanted, or he made a lot of choices.
Yeah. And just one more thing on apes in captivity, they tend to think of themselves as humans, particularly the ones who've been taught sign language. So if you give chimps a pile of pictures and you say, sort these into people and animals. Of course, we are an animal, but anyway, that's how the research protocol was set up. They put their own picture in the people pile, and other chimps
in the animal pile.
Well, 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 well.
Right. How intriguing.
Yeah.
Right.
Over here.
I wonder if there is a top number of people that the Earth can support. And either way, how are we going to cope with that number?
The population problem is a very, very difficult problem. I have no answer for it because there are so many different ingredients in it. Some are political, some are religious. There are so many determinants on how many kids you can have, how many kids you need to have, depending on your income level and what country you're living in and so on. The Earth, you're right, can only support a certain amount. And we are going to either have to have lower population or we're going to have better resources to take care of the populations that we have. I don't have a simple answer. I wish I did.
Well, and that reminds me of something I was going to bring up in your book about our future, which seems to suggest we're going to be eating a lot of kelp and algae.
I do think we will, yes.
Be prepared. And that might be one way of dealing.
I think we will. We all agree, whether the environmentalists agree that we are doomed and there's nothing that we can do, and there are some people who certainly feel that way, and you hear from them and about them all the time. And then there are the others of us who are far more positive. What we can agree on is that we have no idea what the future is going to bring. We don't know how quickly we're going to be able to curb climate change. We don't know what kind of inventions or technologies we're going to invent and how quickly, and ones that involve better food resources. We don't know how this is going to happen. If you look at what's taken place, though, in the last 20 years, 200 years, it's been colossal. Mm-hmm. So I do have some faith that if you have enough highly interconnected, wired up human beings in conversation with each other about these problems, and now you have think groups, we have think groups that include members from all over the planet, that we're going to be able to address some of these. But I don't have any answers for the population problem.
I would just add that, you know, two American kids consume as much as 20 Kenyan kids.
Yes, that's true.
So it's a 1-10 ratio. So yeah. The focus has shifted, at least among feminist health workers, away from trying to get people to have fewer kids to trying to get Western countries to stop consuming so much.
Yeah, and certainly the wealthier countries have the burden of doing the lion's share of the switching to renewables, and just for the reasons you're talking about, and then additionally helping the more vulnerable nations financially and in every other way. And a lot of them are going to be lying around the equator, which is what's hit the hardest. The fastest by climate change. It's going to be our human moral responsibility.
I hope it moves in that direction. I was
touched
in your book by your description of the leader in the Maldives and how he has a goal of zero emissions by something soon, 2016, 2018.
Yeah, but even in India, the Prime Minister of India recently announced that he was switching 400 million people he was transitioning to solar, and also planting 2 billion trees along the highways so that they would absorb the CO2, but also put to work 300,000 out-of-work people, and also create wildlife corridors, and also expose, you know, this very urban species to nature on the way to work, on the way back from work. That's a very good sign.
Hopefully we'll pick that up ourselves.
Oftentimes scientists are accused of doing something or creating something because it can be done, it can be created. I was thinking in terms of the beginning of your discussion, you talked about bringing back a giant woolly mammoth. And I was thinking there might be a rationale for bringing back species that we as humans were directly responsible for making extinct. But I was wondering, what possible rationale could there be for bringing back something, except for that Steven Spielberg movie where they brought back the raptors, whatever. What rationale could there be for bringing back a giant woolly mammoth?
Well, first of all, we've made so many animals go extinct. And as I was saying earlier, that's why it would be odd to put a woolly mammoth embryo inside of an elephant who would carry it to term and raise it and so on. Mm-hmm. We've caused the extinction of so many species. Probably not the Neanderthal, as we used to think. We probably just intermarried. But where would you begin? Yes, there are an awful lot of people who feel guilty. It's an eco-guilt. And that's part of the reason that they want to do that. And another part of the reason for some, definitely, is because we can. Oh, just that, not just the woolly mammoth, it's just that that happens to be a very attractive species for a lot of people, but they also want to bring back all kinds of ancient other species, auks and just lots of other things, quaggas, dodos. You know, they were half horse, kind of half zebra.
I'd like to see the dodo.
Dodos, yeah, lots of things. So that's just one of them. And there is a Pleistocene park that some people have made in Russia. And they're missing a mammoth. What can I tell you? The other animals are not exactly the original horses and bison that our ancestors drew on the cave walls. They're as far back as we could breed them to. And very much like the ones that the Nazis were breeding. And actually, that's something we do all the time. We've been genetically engineering plants and animals for as long as we've been around on the planets. We've just have done it by choosing a couple that have the same characteristics that we like and breeding them together. And so we've been leaving a long caravan of our favorite traits all over the planet. This is why I'm saying, I mean, even the magnolia tree, that it is outside of my study window. I was tweeting about this very thing today. It's not exactly natural. It's not native to there at all, but I consider it part of nature. We all consider these things part of nature, even though they're not exactly natural.
So I encountered permaculture last year around the same time that the Philippines was hit by the big typhoon, and I started this documentary about my work in environment and society there, and it just blew my mind. And now I'm on to social business, which is another like wow. So the feature documentary I'm doing, I want to end it with some sort of like a master plan for the Philippines, a sustainable master plan. And I was wondering if you could point me where I should learn, or in terms of that ambition, even in paper.
Well, I'm not just avoiding the answer, but I think you should email me about that. And the reason is that I might well be able to point you in various directions, but I'd like to be able to think about it rather than just come up with something off the cuff. And there's bound to be several. And there certainly are organizations that are working there to try to keep it sustainable in all different kinds of ways. I have a website, which is just www.dianeackerman.com, and you'll find my email there. And I might well be able to put you, in touch with some of the people who are out there. And anyone who has other questions, please reach me that way. Welcome to 21st century life. And I'm absolutely at Dianessa Ackerman. You probably are a twit also, right?
I actually am not, but
you're not a twit?
I am not, but there may be some progression in my future. When the bonobos learn how to do it, I would tweet a bonobo for sure. Diane, this has been such a delight. Thank you so much.
This has been wonderful too. Thank you.
To all of you. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.